So are you the brains of the outfit or is he? Tell you the truth, I don't think this is a brains kind of operation. This is Movies I Love That No One Talks About. I am your host, Dan Benamor. Today we're talking about the 2000 film, The Way of the Gun. The film stars Ryan Phillippe, Benicio del Toro, Juliette Lewis, James Caan, Taye Diggs, and Nikki Catt. Christopher McQuarrie wrote and directed the film. He wrote The Usual Suspects and has gone on to make previous episode of the show, Jack Reacher, and a bunch of Mission Impossible films. The budget was $8.5 million and it grossed $13.1 million, and it holds a 45% on Rotten Tomatoes. My guest this week is a fan of the show who also went to the Vancouver's film school like I did and reached out to me. His name is Phil Clark. Phil is a screenwriter from Calgary, Alberta, who recently, I mean literally recently, like Friday, graduated from the same program I took at the Vancouver Film School, writing for film and television. Now they've added video games. He's heavily influenced by Sorkin and Tarantino, and he is in, I would say, the prime movie-watching time of his life. Welcome, Phil.
Hey, Dan. Thanks for having me.
Can you tell the good people listening what award you got at graduation, the name of the award they gave you?
So I got what is known as the Lord Baser Cup Award. So it's like the ultimate award, and essentially I get my name on a plaque. I don't know what that does for me, but hey, I've never had my name on a plaque before, so I'll take it.
But what was the personalized thing that your name that they gave you?
One that was, it was, let's go out for a beer and talk about movies award. And it's like, if that's not the most accurate Phil award I can think of, like, yeah, I love going for beer and talking movies. That's what I do. That's all I do with my time.
How old are you right now?
I'm 28.
Okay. So I remember, it's like your life is in stages, right?
Yeah.
You get older, get married is one thing, but then have kids is a very different thing. The stage of life that you are in currently is like the formative movie watching time of life, because there is literally nothing else that you have to do except watch movies. Can you give me the over under how many movies you're watching a week at this point?
Over under. Well, so I have Letterboxd. I don't know if you have Letterboxd, but it's a great way to keep track of all the stuff you watch. Over under, I probably watch 15 a week.
That sounds right. Yeah, that sounds correct. Yeah. It's like when I remember I was living, there was a while I was living in Burbank here in Los Angeles. I had my own place and I worked as a development executive. And I basically would do that all day. And then I would come home and watch movies all night. And that was pretty much my whole life. And now what's going to happen is you're going to eventually get older. You're going to have kids and you're going to spend a lot of time watching like Paw Patrol. And then as soon as the kids are asleep, you've spent the whole day watching things like Paw Patrol and True and the Rainbow Kingdom. And you're going to watch the most fucked up shit you can imagine the second your kids fall asleep, just to shift the mood a little bit.
Oh, just for my sanity. Yeah, I'll be honest. I'm not looking forward to that. I don't know if I have the patience for it. I don't know. Like the stuff that I write is very much anti-Paw Patrol. No offense to Paw Patrol. But I get it. Hey, it's a market. Makes tons of money. I'm pretty sure the latest Paw Patrol movie has like 100% on Rotten Tomatoes. So they're doing something right.
I would like to publicly announce that my wife cried at one point watching the latest Paw Patrol movie. So I think this is actually The Way of the Gun is a movie that would fit that. For other people here who maybe have kids and who are listening to this, you're like, I've been watching Paw Patrol all day. I want to watch something a little edgy. This is pretty edgy. So I just want to talk about the beginning of the movie. We meet Benicio del Toro and Ryan Phillippe, and there's this absurd, I mean, like really, like you almost like you gotta like reorient your brain for a second scene where they're coming out of this nightclub. They pick a fight with Sarah Silverman, of all people, and her boyfriend. And the things that are said to each other, I don't even want to repeat. I mean, it's so over the top. And it feels like McQuarrie is really like exercising something. And I did a little research and he said that when he wrote the script, the first thing I did was to write a list of every taboo, everything I knew a cowardly executive would refuse to accept from a sympathetic leading man. And that is 100% felt in the opening scene in which we establish that these guys are misogynistic and not like a little misogynistic. I think they punch a woman in the face, homophobic. They're it's not like a big part of this movie is that these are not movie scumbag guys. These are like actual scumbag guys. Was it weird rewatching it? Because you rewatched it for the show, right?
Yeah. I mean, are they defensible? Not at all. But for me, what I love about this movie and what I love that McQuarrie does is that he is willing to go to that place to come up with some of the, like, I was wondering when you were doing the quote, I'm like, is he going to say the thing? I'm like, there's no way he's going to say it. I'm kind of glad you didn't, but like, there's stuff that they say in that opening that is so colorfully creative in the worst way possible. And you're right. I'm sure it was McQuarrie exercising some kind of demons. Rewatching it yesterday, like, I don't know. I love it because it just goes to that place. It's not afraid to say and do terrible, awful things. And it does this thing I love where movies in the first 2 minutes, either you're on board with it,
right,
or you're absolutely not. And this is a movie where, like, I'm on board for this. This tells me everything I need to know about these characters, and I'm invested for the next 2 hours. Also, I just like to point out the club they leave, the name of it is just called Dive Bar. And I love that. I love, it's like in Gone Girl, right? Ben Affleck and Carrie Coon's, the bar that they own is just called The Bar. And if you have something called The Dive Bar, I'm invested immediately. Yeah.
Well, I think what's interesting about it is that, because for me, I think film school me, I would have been like, I think that the fact that it's so subversive and it so goes against the norm is immediately exciting from just an academic kind of level. I think for me, as I've gotten older, like I process these things a little bit differently, and I was thrown by it. And I was sort of like, what? Like, I hope somebody kills these guys. Like, why should I? But what's interesting about the movie is that the movie really does earn that. Like it is purposeful. It's not just doing it for its own sake, right? There is a purpose to it that pays off in the end. And you don't really know what that is until you get to the end of the movie. But if you can make it to the end of the movie, it so pays that off in a really great way. So basically we get Parker and Longbaugh, that's Benicio and Ryan Phillippe. They're low-level petty criminals. They're just doing small-time scam kind of stuff. And they're at a sperm donation clinic, and they overhear a telephone conversation detailing a $1 million payment to a surrogate mother for bearing the child of money launderer Hale Chittuck, great name. Parker and Longbaugh resolve to kidnap the surrogate, whose name is Robin, but their attempt escalates into a shootout with her bodyguards, who are Jeffers and Obex. They're able to elude the bodyguards. The bodyguards get arrested. They're bailed out. They go back to Chittuck. We meet Joe Sarno, who is sort of this fixer guy. Sarno begins coordinating Robin's rescue. Longbaugh contacts her gynecologist, Dr. Alan Painter, and orders him to a truck stop to examine Robin. There's a great bit there where the doctor's like, they ask him, who are the parents of the baby? And he's like, you guys don't know that. And essentially it's as if they thought they were just kidnapping some random person, but the parent of the child is this extremely dangerous money launderer guy. 34 minutes in, this is the moment where I was in for me. We meet this guy whose name is Abner. And, you know, he's just sitting on a couch. We don't really know anything about him. We just kind of pop into him, and he's got these guns and he's loading them. And you think, all right, well, this must be some guy who they're calling to help with the kidnapping. Then he puts the guns in a pillowcase. Then he spins the pillowcase around. Then he takes a gun out, and he realizes he's doing like a Russian roulette thing. And the first gun, he pulls the trigger and it doesn't kill him. So he takes out another gun. And as he's going to use the second gun, that's when he gets a call from James Caan. I think that's the greatness of McQuarrie, right? It's like this absurdly specific, almost sort of funny. Like, what would you make of that scene?
I loved it because it infers that there is a backstory to that guy. You know very little about him, but the fact that we're introed into him as casually as possible, as you say, like playing, pillow Russian roulette, which is the most hitman thing I've ever seen in my life. Like, I want to know why he's there. You know, does he live alone? Is he with somebody? I have so many questions and they're never answered. And I love that. Like, there's so many things that are brought up in this movie. Like, for instance, to jump to a point, the whole thing with the doc and what happened in Baltimore.
Yeah.
I know you're from Baltimore. So as I was rewatching it yesterday, I'm like, what does Dan feel about Baltimore? Because I know that it's never addressed. It's just something that the doc did back in the day that he fucked up horribly. but we never know the specificity of it. But I like that it's dangled there. McCore loves to just put out these ideas and hint at this larger world that you'll never see. And that's just the mark of like a great writer, I think, who can just, you know, infer and imply without overly explaining so many things, which a lot of people do.
Yeah, totally. So James Caan kind of recruits in Abner. And I want to just take a second to talk about James Caan in this movie. So he has this scene where he talks to the bodyguards and he basically says, hey, listen, I'm the fixer guy. I handle situations like this. I always love that character to start with. He's kind of the only person I would argue you can sincerely root for in the movie, because his goal is to rescue Robin and the baby from kidnapper. I mean, it's like an actual altruist. It's a positive goal. He seems like, you know, like I'm rooting for him. I hope he kills them. I want to read a quote from an interview. Macquarie said this about James Caan. Jimmy Caan came to us having read the script. I first saw him in the bar at the Four Seasons in Los Angeles. He walked in and shouted across the crowded room, "You're a sick fuck." We hit it off immediately. Still, I'd heard stories about Jimmy and was concerned. So I called James Gray, who worked with Caan on The Yards. He said, "You don't want Jimmy in your movie. You need Jimmy in your movie." Years later, I approached Robert Duvall for Jack Reacher. He told me Jimmy had called first and urged him to take the role. It's great.
What a guy.
What did he say?
I mean, that scene where he's talking to Nikki Cat and Taye Diggs, like, it just, there's a tone shift. And I don't know specifically what kind of tone it is, but like, it's James Caan, right? It's Sonny from The Godfather, right? It's the dad from Elf. Not that that matters, but it's like, you just have this well-regarded thespian coming in and just giving, and I know it's an overused word, but gravitas. Like, he's so magnetic. He's James Caan, so of course you're gonna listen to him. And I had a little joke note here, but it's like, take a shot every time he uses the word adjudicate or adjudication. You'll be pumping your stomach inside 5 minutes, I swear. But like, the level of the dialogue, I think is just incredibly whip smart throughout the movie, but especially his character, like his voice. McCory gets that voice of that older gentleman that's seen so much shit and knows how to like talk his way in and out of a room. Like, it's so good.
Yeah, I think, I mean, I have a lot of Caan stuff in this movie. I think it's one of his better later career performances. So there's an examination of Robin by the doctor. The doctor returns to Chiduk. We find out that the doctor is actually Chiduk's son. And we find out that Jeffers is one of the bodyguards and Chiduk's wife are romantically involved. Longbaugh calls from a motel south of the Mexican border and demands a $15 million ransom. Jeffers and Obex, tempted by the money, begin forming a plan to save the child and keep the money. As Longbaugh hangs up the telephone outside the motel, he's approached by Sarno, who identifies himself as the bagman and offers to pay $1 million if they surrender Robin and simply walk away. Longbaugh, who is clearly skeptical of the offer, declines it, but he accepts Sarno's subsequent offer to buy him a cup of coffee. And they have coffee and they talk about the state of their professions and the character of criminals and how no one takes being a criminal seriously anymore. Longbaugh says that they want to be criminals more than they want to commit crimes. And they leave the coffee shop and Sarno tells Longbaugh that he seems like a good guy and he ought to get out of the business. And Longbaugh replies, "What would I do then?" You know, again, he kind of makes the money offer. Again, he says no. And they shake hands and just kind of go their separate ways. I think that, you know, I want to hear what you think about this. To me, this is the strength of the movie, is that these scenes that in other movies would be sort of like, you'd be looking at your watch and you'd be like, all right, can we get moving here? Like, sort of like act two, we're building it up slowly kind of scenes. That's like the funnest scenes in the movie. It's just guys talking to each other.
Yeah, I mean, McQuarrie says it a lot, but like, he says how generally this would be considered quote unquote shoe leather. Yeah. You know, this is cutting room floor stuff. For me personally, as a writer, dialogue is definitely my strength. And it's my favorite thing to write. And as you said, like that scene where they buy the coffee and they're just talking, shooting the shit. That's my favorite scene in the whole movie. And it, you know, like the car chases are great. The shootouts are great. All the action crime stuff that we love is awesome. But my favorite scene is Benicio del Toro and James Caan shooting the breeze in a little restaurant, drinking a coffee, because it feels like, as absurd as this movie is, those feel like real human character moments, and you can still do that. And I think, again, it's a test to to McQuarrie and his trusting of, no, this is important. And this just, it illuminates character so, so much. And a lot of what we're told writing wise is, you know, you have to move the plot forward. You have to move the plot forward. Things need to keep going. But I love movies that say, no, we're going to stop. We're going to have an extended scene of two people talking. And it's riveting. That it, like, it's theater. And I love it. Like, I wish more movies did it.
Yeah. We're taking an early break because the last sort of like big chunk of this movie, there's so much great stuff that is all connected to each other. So we're going to just take a quick break for the sponsor and we'll be right back. Movies I Love That No One Talks About is brought to you by Virtual Pitch Fest. Virtual Pitch Fest is a trusted industry source that specializes in connecting screenwriters with production companies and representatives. With Virtual Pitch Fest, writers can search through an online database, almost like a dating site, to see what 500 plus participating companies are looking for. They can then send short written pitches on their scripts to chosen companies with the assurance of a guaranteed response back. That's right, guaranteed, you get an answer, you get a fair shot. That's a really critical difference with this service compared to some of the other online pitch services for writers. To date, site connections have led to 150 plus success stories, including produced films. There's actually a Bruce Willis, Megan Fox movie that was recently produced directly because of Virtual Pitch Fest. Just a writer who, you know, was relatively unknown, went on there, did a pitch. The pitch was picked up by a producer, and then that ended up becoming this movie. There's also been dozens of other script deals, many writers landing representation. If this sounds like something that could be useful to you, check out Virtual Pitch Fest at virtualpitchfest.com. Okay, we are back. So Longbaugh returns to his room where Parker and Robin are playing cards. Robin explains she was secretly impregnated by Dr. Painter. Sarno then returns to Chittuck's home to plan the next step. Jeffers comes to realize that Robin is Sarno's daughter. Jeffers, Obex, and Painter leave to meet with the kidnappers while Sarno departs separately with the ransom. At the motel, Parker is having second thoughts. As he confers with Longbaugh outside the motel room, Robin takes the opportunity to seize a shotgun and barricade herself inside. We hear sirens in the distance. Parker and Longbaugh hastily escape. Robin emerges. The Mexican police arrive. Jeffers, Obex, and Painter show up. It becomes like a literal Mexican standoff. Parker and Longbaugh are on a nearby hilltop and open fire. There's a shootout. A bunch of people die. And I want to be really clear about this. It was funny. If you look at the Wikipedia plot synopsis, it says the shootout leaves two officers dead and Obex wounded. What happens is there's a Mexican police officer. There's two Mexican police officers, but one of them is shot by Benicio del Toro. That guy has done absolutely nothing wrong. Literally, he's just doing his job. Could be the nicest guy ever, you know.
Yeah.
There is no way to defend the morality of Benicio del Toro shooting this guy. And McQuarrie talks about this stuff in interviews about the movie a lot. The idea of like challenging you as the audience member, like, are you still empathizing with these guys? Like, are you actually like that, like the way that it doesn't give you the comfort of them being defensible.
I mean, again, maybe it's an age thing, but for me as like a 28-year-old, I'm like, hell yeah, fucking murder everybody. You know, like this is a movie where there are no rules. He's doing a job. Yes, I'm sure the police officer was a perfectly good guy and morally upright and all that, but I'm not here for that guy. I'm here for Benicio del Toro to snipe people. And it's like, yes, that's what I want to see. So, and yeah, maybe it's an age thing. I don't know.
I think it would be fascinating to, like, we should re-record this podcast in like 15 years. And I would be interested to see like how you think about it differently. It totally connects for me too. Like, I think when I was younger, I remember I was always the guy, like, especially when I went to college, I'd have people, because they knew I was really into movies, they'd be like, what should I watch tonight? And I'd be like, oh, you should watch this. And I would give them this like crazy, insane, you know, and then they would come back and they'd be like, what is the matter with you? Like, this is what you wanted us to watch? Parker and Longbaugh torture Obex to learn Robin's location while Jeffers confines Robin in a room in a Mexican brothel. Jeffers forces Painter to perform a cesarean section to retrieve the baby, despite Robin's confession the child is hers and Painter's and is not Chittuck's. Meanwhile, the heavily armed Parker and Longball infiltrate the brothel. Abner dies of a gunshot wound sustained earlier, which I was very upset about. Did you notice? I think it was particularly noticeable. So James Caan goes to Abner. Did you notice in this movie, James Caan is not capable of moving his neck?
Because of the bullet scar on the neck.
Is that the idea?
That's my guess, because he does have the scar on his neck. It looks like a bullet wound. Again, one of those things. It's there. You never address it. I did note that, yeah, he's never turned in the neck. So I feel like that's a character choice because of the previous injury getting shot in the throat.
He's like Val Kilmer in the bat suit. Like, he can't move. Yeah. His neck has to go with his body. Totally. I genuinely wondered. I was like, did James Caan have like a back surgery or something before they filmed this movie? But I love, again, just with Corey, right? So he's in the car with Abner. Abner is bleeding to death from the gunshot wound. And at a certain point, Abner is quiet. And Caan kind of like opens the door to leave. And then Abner sort of like wakes up. And so then he's sort of like, okay, I'll stay with him. And then Abner says, hey, if it's not too much trouble, I'd like to die alone. You almost have to be a writer director to pull that off, right? Like if it's your script and somebody else is directing it, you really got to be mind meld with the director to like, because that's so specific.
It really is. I mean, and there's also just like little details that I kind of want to bring up, just again, just touches that I love, like the early on before they kidnap Robin, when it's them, they're playing cards because they're into playing cards, right? And they're betting with pennies. And, you know, obviously pennies are obsolete at this point, but like just little details like that, that I feel like are little notes that McQuarrie wants to put in. It just, again, what are you going to do while you're killing time? You're going to bet with pennies, you know, or you touched on like the torture scene, right? They're torturing him with like barbed wire and they're ratcheting him up in like, I don't know, 15 feet off the ground. Like there's just certain things that I feel like, yeah, as a writer director, you know exactly what you're doing. You know what it looks like. And communicating that to everybody, I think, is a lot easier when you are both the writer and the director.
By the way, beautiful, beautiful torture scene. Like they shot it at magic hour as the sun is setting. It was like the most gorgeous torture.
Exactly. I was like, did Roger Deakins come in for a guest spot? Like, this looks incredible. This is the most beautiful torture scene I've ever seen in my life. I don't know about this. I had that moment too with Abner yesterday where I was laughing because I'm like, I'm that moment where it's like, I'm kind of James Caan in this scenario. Like, your buddy's dying and that's terrible, but like you kind of want to leave. And then he's like, no, don't, hold on. And I was like, what is this? This is incredible. You don't get this in any other movie. This is a stroke of genius.
The ensuing gunfight leaves Parker wounded, turns in another standoff. Painter shoots Jeffers. Sarno arrives with a group of men in the ransom, which they stack in the courtyard. Parker wants to kidnap Robin and Painter again, but Longbaugh, guilt-ridden after seeing her condition, responds, she's had enough. This is another really interesting part of the movie. So both Ryan Phillippe and Benicio essentially take turns feeling some kind of morality, probably for the first time in their entire lives. Earlier, Ryan was kind of like, hey, you know, maybe we shouldn't do this. And he asked Benicio something to the effect of, what are you going to say when you die and you meet God? And Benicio says, I'm going to tell him I was framed. So that's earlier. And then after Benicio sees, you know, the C-section going on and all that, he suddenly has like actual morality and feels bad and whatever. And I think that's the real secret weapon of the movie, is that we're used to a kind of softened anti-hero, right? So the softened anti-hero version of this would be, yeah, these guys are sort of criminals, but they're only ripping off people who kind of deserve it, right? And yeah, they're a little rough around the edges, but mostly it's just kind of like they're breaking balls in a way that we think is funny. So there's nothing really that objectionable that they're doing. And in that kind of movie, when you get to the inevitable redemption arc, it sort of feels like, well, what are we redeeming them from? Like, it's not that drastic of an arc because they weren't that bad. What McQuarrie's doing here is like, these guys are truly bad people. There is no two ways about it. There's no way to interpret it that they're not bad people. And so when you finally get to that moment where they both have these glimpses of humanity, it actually plays. Like, you really feel it because we've gone somewhere. They have changed drastically.
Totally. I mean, you know, considering what they go through, like at the end, you look at Ryan Phillippe, who, again, I need to shout out Ryan Phillippe, incredible actor, super underappreciated. I love what you did with the Breach episode, talking to Billy Ray, and how he brought up that, like, yes, the Chris Cooper role is the meatier role, it's the showier role, but you need somebody like Ryan Phillippe to really anchor and be the quote-unquote straight man to the insanity. And here, I think he does a great job of that too, where it's like, you've just seen so much crazy stuff. And of course, Benicio del Toro, we love him with his manic, chaotic energy. You need a Ryan Phillippe to ground that. And looking at Ryan Phillippe at the end of that movie, and he's just like, he's done too. Like, he's like, oh, I realize, you know, and it's not like a last minute, oh, I'm finding redemption. But like, just in his performance, I buy that turn. And I buy that he's finding some kind of solace with his life, some kind of acceptance of where, who he's become at this point. And again, I give that mostly, I mean, the writing is great, directing is great, but I give it to his performance there for sure.
In the research, McQuarrie has said openly that they did not want him. And he refused, really? He refused to take no for an answer.
Wow.
Like, he just was persistent and, you know, is obviously just like a really hard worker. I think he gained like 20 pounds of muscle. Like he, right. You know, he did, he really committed. So despite realizing that the money is bait, you know, Parker and Longbaugh have charged headlong into this ambush. It's very Butch and Sundance. Parker and Longbaugh are the real last names of Butch and Sundance.
Right.
And this scene, this final part of it is shot like where they shot Butch and Sundance or something. Like there's a lot of Butch and Sundance connections here. In the ensuing firefight, all of Sarno's men are killed. It's super gnarly. A guy definitely gets shot in the dick. I don't know if you caught that. There's a part
there was a couple dick shots for sure.
Yeah. Like it's like a normal, you know, normal scene, shootout, whatever. And you see across the courtyard, this dude gets shot in the dick, like it almost like looked like a shotgun or something. Like it was just, and it's like a throwaway. And you're just watching, you're like, oh man. Ryan Phillippe leaps for cover into this empty well, but it's filled with broken beer bottles. It's just a really rough scene. Sarno manages to shoot and cripple the already wounded Parker and Longbaugh like a boss. I mean, really, again, James Caan is, in my opinion, the best part of the movie. He calls for an ambulance. Painter emerges with Robin and the baby. Lying in a pool of blood, Parker and Longbaugh call out to Sarno, informing him that the baby is in fact Robin and Painter's, and thus Sarno's grandson. Parker wonders aloud if this fact will influence Sarno to let them keep the child. Robin and the baby are taken away in the ambulance with Painter, Sarno, and the money, leaving Parker and Longbaugh to die. Days later, Chittick's wife reveals that she's pregnant, presumably by Jeffers, right?
Yeah, presumably.
Yeah. So that's probably going to be, like, she tells about pregnant, but I mean, Jeffers is black and she's white, so you know, it's probably going to be pretty obvious that that's not Chittick's son.
And yeah, in 9 months, he's going to be like, why does my baby look like Taye Diggs? What's going on?
Yeah, there's going to be some questions.
Definitely.
So just as we wrap up, I wanted to know, first of all, do you know other people who like this movie?
You're the first. You're the first. That's why I'm so glad. Like this is, when you asked me my list of like what movies I'd like to talk about, this was one of them because crime is my favorite genre, but also The Way of the Gun is perfect for this podcast for that reason, because it's a movie that I personally love and I've never had a conversation with about anybody until you today. So thank you. That's at least two of us. In a world of 7.8 billion people and counting, I know two people now who like this movie.
Yeah, it'll be interesting when I release it. I mean, I had always had the impression that it was sort of had become a little bit of a cult film and is a movie that people has later been reevaluated. But I never heard anybody be like, hey, did you ever see Way of the Gun? Like that has never happened.
Yeah. I mean, there's a weird connection, but the only cultural influence I'm aware of this movie has is, and go with me here. So two nights ago on my list of watching 15 movies a week, I ended up watching a movie called The Life Before Her Eyes, which is by the director that did House of Sand and Fog.
Oh, yeah. I talked to that guy.
Oh, did you? Oh, no way. No.
Yeah, no. I was going to hire him when I was an exec to do a movie for us. And yeah, I talked to him.
Yeah. Oh, there you go. But I mean, I love House of Sand and Fog. Anyways, that's why I watched this other movie, Life Before Her Eyes. And it's starring Uma Thurman and Evan Rachel Wood. They play the same character. And Evan Rachel Wood is a high school student. She survives a school shooting, super traumatic, very intense, and then grows up to be Uma Thurman, who has PTSD and is dealing with this. Like, it's a very heavy movie, and not like Way of the Gun. The connection, though, is there's a scene, again, I shit you not, I was watching this like 2 days before we recorded this episode. She's making dinner and she hears gunshots coming from the other room. So she panics and she goes in to see her daughter watching TV. And what is her daughter watching? The Way of the Gun.
Whoa.
Yeah. And I only noted it because it was like, because I paused, I was like, wait a minute, is that Way of the Gun? Is that the movie I'm talking about 2 days from now? And it is, because it's the shot of Nikki Catt and Taye Diggs, like with the shoot or the initial kidnapping when they're shooting the car and the car drives away. And I rewound it and like, yeah, that's 100% Way of the Gun. That I think that's its cultural influence, is an Uma Thurman movie.
That I bet you that guy, that's the director, like real, that, you know, either knows McCrory or is just basically trying to give McCrory some props. That's interesting. So. This is a quote from the same Den of Geek interview. McCrory said about the reception of the film: critics didn't kill my film. The shitty marketing didn't kill it. I killed it when I set out to make a film that lectured instead of entertained. Bottom line, most people just didn't like it. But they didn't need critics to tell them that. I mean, I think that's sort of the interesting thing for me to talk about with this movie, is that I think for you and I, as more adventurous moviegoers, we're more inclined to watch that opening scene where they, if I remember correctly, call women the C word, punch a woman. I think Benicio del Toro like kisses a woman while they're in the middle of the fight. They use the gay slur multiple times early in the movie. And I think that for us, we're sort of like, when we see something like that in the movie, we're like, huh, interesting choice. I wonder where he's going with this. Exactly. And I think, but then I think for the average moviegoer, I wonder if for them, they're like, well, screw this, I don't want to watch this movie. Like, I wonder if people, part of the reason the movie was not well received is that people were so turned off by the beginning that they didn't really stay with the movie to the end. Cause really the movie's about these guys actually having some type of redemption. Like, it actually has like sort of an upshot to it. But I wonder if that is part of the reason why it wasn't better received.
I mean, it must be, and I'm roughly paraphrasing, but I know, cause I've listened to a ton of McCrory podcasts as well. And he said how, you know, cause he won the Oscar for Usual Suspects, right? And which is like a blessing and a curse. Like, imagine getting the highest honor and then being like, oh, I'm super young. What do I? It's like, if I got an Oscar today, I would have no idea what to do with it. I would not know how to handle it. And I'm sure, you know, he got tons of offers. Like, okay, do Usual Suspects. Do the, and he's like, no. As a filmmaker, as a writer, it's like, I totally get him not wanting to do The Usual Suspects, but everybody wanting him to do another version of that. So 5 years go by, and then we get The Way of the Gun, which I'm paraphrasing, but I'm pretty sure he said it was like, the most, if you want the most crime movie to ever crime, I will give you that movie. It's called Way of the Gun. And I don't care if you like it or not. This is my response to what you want. And then nobody, it's like, it's the, you know, it's musicians or it's bands, you know, having a very consistent style and tone, and then coming out with a new album that's completely different because people want something different. And then they complain that it's not what it used to be. So it's like, he's just doing a different album and they didn't appreciate it. So then it took him another 12 years to direct something, being, of course, Jack Reacher. Like, I don't, you can't make everybody happy. At the end of the day, I just want, hey, make the movie you want to make, do the best thing you can, and hopefully people like it. And if it's just you and me, then I'm okay with that too.
McCrory is fascinating. I think I read or heard this also, that there was a point when he sort of a little bit washed his hands of it. Like, he was, I think he was on vacation with his wife or something. And he tells, I think I remember him telling a story about being like, his wife telling him like, hey, this is like the happiest you've been in a while. And he sort of like, you know, there was a moment where he was sort of in the wasteland a little bit. And then he kind of comes back, you know, he does Jack Reacher, which I adore, which I did on the show previously. And then he starts doing the Mission Impossible movies. And now it basically seems like basically any movie Tom Cruise makes, McCrory has to either write or direct.
Yeah.
It's funny because it's like, he's come totally full circle. Like, he was a guy who made this movie, The Way of the Gun, which very clearly was an attempt to reject the establishment movie system.
Yeah.
And then now he is the establishment, literally. I mean, he's making these Mission Impossible movies that are all like $250 million.
Yeah, I mean, that's the dream, right? You start out, you know, doing the indie thing and grinding, and then eventually getting to a place where you can do the, 200, 250, 300, whatever those budgets are, like movies that people love. I mean, I don't know people that dislike the Mission Impossible franchise. And I, you know, it's funny going to Mission Impossible, right? Because as everyone knows, they were individual directors until McQuarrie did 5 and 6 together. And now he's doing 7 and 8. Yeah, like I love that that's where his life went. Like he, you know, struggled for a really long time. He's also talked about he had a John Wilkes Booth movie he wanted to make that never got made, that nobody would look at. He wanted to make an Alexander the Great movie, which of course this was around the time of the Colin Farrell version, so that got tanked. But it's inspiring, you know, coming from a writing student, I guess now graduate, like, you know, yes, I'm gonna write tons and tons of stuff and a lot of it won't get made, but every once in a while something will take, something will get made. And it's just it's quite inspirational to people like me who are starting out, because they want, you know, stuff to get made. And again, not everything will, but the more you work, eventually you'll hopefully get a Mission Impossible franchise, and there you go.
I sincerely hope he goes through another phase where he's like, well, I've made 200+ million movies back to back to back. I think I'm gonna go make, you know, basically the Way of the Gun too, like little small movies that are character driven, where, because I mean, you know what's interesting is Way of the Gun, he wanted to do a movie where he would have complete creative control. Yeah. And Benicio is the one who told him, like, you should do a crime movie. They'll leave you alone. Like, you'll be able to do what you want to do. And yeah. And I think that, ironically, now, if he wanted to go do another Way of the Gun kind of movie, and he was like, hey, I just want $10 million. I'm, like, one of the most commercially successful filmmakers now of the last 5 years. They would let him do it.
Right.
And so I kind of, selfishly, I hope that he... that's the next pivot, is he goes and makes a couple of those little smaller character driven movies, because he's so good at that.
I would love to see that. My question for you is, like, where would he pitch that? Because as you know, people say, like, the mid-range budget movie doesn't exist anymore. Either it's, you know, a Blumhouse horror or it's a MCU. There's no in between, and I miss the in between movies. Like,
does, yeah, it's
like Netflix.
Well, so you can only do it if you're somebody like him or Steven Soderbergh. So, for example, Steven Soderbergh just did No Sudden Move for HBO,
Incredible. So good.
And when he does it, he's like, hey, I'm doing this. And he gets a bunch of really great actors. I think Benicio's in that too, right?
Yeah, he is. Yeah.
And so that's kind of the only way you can do it. Most filmmakers are squeezed out from that because you're right. They don't really make them anymore. You have to be somebody that's really got serious juice. And then it's almost like, I'm going to slum it from my, you know, $250 million movie, and I'll do this little small crime movie. And then you get, you know, 12 of the best actors on the planet to be in your movie. And then suddenly it becomes exciting to the HBO or the Amazon or Hulu, et cetera.
Totally.
Yeah. Well, that's the Way of the Gun. I genuinely am curious, like, if you're listening to this and you've actually seen this movie, you know, write in, tell us what you think. Like, I honestly want to know if other people like this. That is our show for this week. If you want to keep up with the show, join our Facebook group at Movies I Love That No One Talks About, or follow me on Instagram at the same. If you dig the show, please give us a 5-star review on iTunes. It's a big help to the show. I want to thank my guest, Phil Clark. Until next time, bye-bye.